The actual statement came out yesterday. We both read it. Bobby, Soren said with a sigh that said he was tired of explaining simple things to her, but a grin that said he really wasn't. This is how the game is played. Mars releases a statement condemning our actions. We go back channel and find an early draft. If it was harsher than the actual statement that was released, then someone in the Dip Corps argued to tone it down. That means they're trying to avoid escalating. If it was milder in the early draft, then they're deliberately escalating to provoke a response. But since they know you'll get those early drafts, then that's meaningless. They'll just make sure you get leaks that give you the impression they want you to have. See? Now you're getting it, Soren said. What your opponent wants you to think is useful data in figuring out what they think. So get the early draft, okay? Do it before the end of the day. But no one talks to me anymore because now I'm the UN's pet Martian. And even though I'm not a traitor, it is entirely possible that everyone else thinks I am, she thought. Okay. Bobby pulled up the newly revised list and made the first connection request of the day. Bobby, Avasarala yelled from her desk. There was any number of electronic means for getting Bobby's attention, but she almost never saw Avasarala use them. She yanked her earbud free and stood up. Soren's smirk was of the psychic variety. His face didn't change at all. Ma'am, Bobby said, taking a short step into Avasarala's office. You bellowed? No one likes a smartass, Avasarala said, not looking up from her desk terminal. Where's my first draft of that report? It's almost lunchtime. Bobby stood a little straighter and clasped her arms behind her back. Sir, I regret to inform you that I have been unable to find anyone willing to release the early draft of the report to me. Are you standing at attention? Avasarala said, looking up at her for the first time. Jesus, I'm not about to march you out to the firing squad. Did you try everyone on the list? Yes, I... Bobby stopped for a moment and took a deep breath, then took a few more steps into the office. Quietly, she said, No one talks to me. The old woman lifted a snow-white eyebrow. That's interesting. It is, Bobby said. Avasarala smiled at her, a warm, genuine smile, then poured tea out of a black iron pot into two small teacups. Sit down, she said, waving at a chair next to her desk. When Bobby remained standing, Avasarala said, Seriously, sit the fuck down. 5 minutes talking to you and I can't tilt my head forward again for an hour. Bobby sat, hesitated, and took one of the small teacups. It wasn't much larger than a shot glass, and the tea inside was very dark and smelled unpleasant. She took a small sip and burned her tongue. It's a Lapsang Souchong, Avasarala said. My husband buys it for me. What do you think? I think it smells like hobo feet, Bobby replied. No shit, but Arjun loves it, and it's not bad once you get used to drinking it. Bobby nodded and took another sip, but didn't reply. Okay, so, Avasarala said, You're the Martian who was unhappy and got tempted over to the other side by a powerful old lady with lots of shiny prizes to offer. You're the worst kind of traitor, because ultimately everything that's happened to you since you came to Earth was because you were pouting. Shut the fuck up now, dear. The grown-up is talking. Bobby shut up and drank her awful tea. But, Avasarala continued, the same sweet smile on her wrinkled face. If I were on the other team, you know who I'd send misinformation leaks to? Me, Bobby said. You. Because you're desperate to prove your value to your new boss, and they can send you blatantly false information and not really care if they fuck your shit up in the long run. If I were the Martian counter-espionage wonks, I'd have already recruited one of your closest friends back home and be using them to funnel a mountain's worth of false data in your direction. My closest friends are all dead, Bobby thought. But no one is talking to you from back home, which means two things. They are still trying to figure out my game in keeping you here, and they don't have a misinformation campaign in place because they're as confused as we are. You'll be contacted by someone in the next week or so. They'll ask you to leak information from my office, but they'll ask it in such a way that winds up giving you a whole lot of false information. If you're loyal and spy for them, great. If not, and you tell me what they asked for, also great. Maybe they'll get lucky, and you'll do both. Bobby put the teacup back on the desk. Her hands were in fists. This, Bobby said, is why everyone hates politicians. No, they hate us because we have power. Bobby, this isn't how your mind likes to work, and I respect that. I don't have time to explain things to you, Avasarala said, the smile disappearing like it had never been. So just assume I know what I'm doing, and that when I ask you to do the impossible, it's because even your failure helps our cause somehow. Our cause? We're on the same team here. Team Let's Not Lose Together. That is us, isn't it? Yes, Bobby said, glancing at the Buddha in his shrine. He smiled at her serenely. Just one of the team, his round face seemed to say. Yes, it is. Then get the fuck back out there and start calling everyone all over again. This time take detailed notes on who refuses to help you and the exact words they use in their refusal, okay? Solid copy on that, ma'am. Good, Avasarala said, smiling gently again. Get out of my office. Familiarity might breed contempt, but Bobby hadn't much liked Soren right from the start. Sitting next to him for several days had ratcheted up her dislike to a whole new level. When he wasn't ignoring her, he was condescending. He talked too loud on his phone, even when she was trying to carry on a conversation of her own. Sometimes he sat on her desk, talking to visitors. He wore too much cologne. The worst thing was he ate cookies all day. It was impressive, given his rail-thin build, and Bobby was not generally the kind of person who cared at all about other people's dietary habits. But his preferred brand of cookie came out of the break room vending machine in a foil packet that crinkled every time he reached into it. At first, this had only been annoying. But after a couple of days of the crinkle-crunch-chomp-and-smack radio theater, she'd had enough. She dropped her latest pointless connection and turned to stare at him. He ignored her and tapped on his desk terminal. Soren, she said, meaning to ask him to dump the damn cookies out on a plate or a napkin so she didn't have to hear that infuriating crinkle sound anymore. Before she could get more than his name out, he held up a finger to shush her and pointed at his earbud. No, he said. Not really a good... Bobby wasn't sure if he was talking to her or someone on the phone, so she got up and moved over to his desk, sitting on the edge of it. He gave her a withering glare, but she just smiled and mouthed, "I'll wait." The edge of his desk creaked a little under her weight. He turned his back to her. "I understand," he said, "but this is not a good time to discuss." "I see. I can probably..." "I see, yes. Foster won't..." "Yes, yes, I understand. I'll be there." He turned back around and tapped his desk, killing the connection. "What?" "I hate your cookies. The constant crinkle of the package is driving me insane." "Cookies?" Soren said, a baffled expression on his face. Bobby thought that it might be the first honest emotion she'd ever seen there. "Yeah, can you put them on a..." Bobby started, but before she could finish, Soren grabbed up the package and tossed them into the recycling bin next to his desk. "Happy?" "Well, I don't have time for you right now, Sergeant." "Okay," Bobby said, and went back to her desk. Sarin kept fidgeting like he had more to say, so Bobby didn't call the next person on her list. She waited for him to speak. Probably the cookie thing had been a mistake on her part. Really, it wasn't a big deal. If she weren't under so much pressure, it wasn't the sort of thing she'd probably even notice. When Sarin finally spoke up, she'd apologize for being so pushy about it and then offer to buy him a new package. Instead of speaking, he stood up. "Sarin, I..." Bobby started, but Sarin ignored her and unlocked a drawer on his desk. He pulled out a small bit of black plastic. Probably because she'd just heard him say the name Foster, Bobby recognized it as the memory stick Avasarala had given him a few days earlier. Foster was the data services guy, so she assumed he was finally getting around to taking care of that little task, which would at least get him away from the office for a few minutes. Until he turned and headed for the elevators. Bobby had done a little gopher work, running things back and forth to data services, and knew that their office was on the same floor, and in the opposite direction of the elevators. Huh. She was tired. She was half sick with guilt, and she wasn't even all that sure what she felt guilty about. She disliked the man, anyway. The hunch that popped into her head was almost certainly a result of her own paranoia and addled image of the world. She got up, following him. "This is really stupid," she said to herself, smiling and nodding at a page who hurried by. She was over 2 meters tall on a planet of short people. She wasn't going to blend. Sarin climbed into an elevator. Bobby stopped outside the doors and waited. Through the aluminum and ceramic doors, she heard him ask someone to press 1. "Going all the way to the street level, then." She hit the down button and took the next elevator to the bottom floor. Of course, he wasn't in sight when she got there. A giant Martian woman running around the lobby of the UN building would draw a little attention, so she scrapped that as a plan. A wave of uncertainty, failure, and despair lapped at the shoreline of her mind. Forget that it was an office building. Forget that there were no armed enemy, no squad behind her. Forget that, and look at the logic of the situation on the ground. Think tactically. Be smart. "I need to be smart," she said. A short woman in a red suit who had just come up and pressed the elevator call button overheard her and said, "What?" "I need to be smart," Bobby told her. "Can't go running off half-cocked. Not even when doing something insane and stupid," she thought. "I see," the woman said, then pushed the elevator call button again several times. Next to the elevator control panel was a courtesy terminal. "If you can't find the target, restrict the target's degrees of freedom. Make them come to you." "Right." Bobby hit the button for the lobby reception desk. An automated system with an extremely realistic and sexually ambiguous voice asked how it could assist her. "Please page Sarin Cotwald to the lobby reception desk," Bobby said. The computer on the other end of the line thanked her for using the UN automated courtesy system and dropped the connection. Sarin might not have his terminal on, or it could be set to ignore incoming pages. Or he might ignore this one all on his own. She found a couch with a sightline to the desk and shifted a ficus to provide her cover. 2 minutes later, Sarin trotted up to the reception desk, his hair more wind-blown than usual. He must have already been all the way outside when he got the page. He began talking to one of the human receptionists. Bobby moved across the lobby to a little coffee and snack kiosk and hid as best she could. After typing on her desk for a moment, the receptionist pointed at the terminal next to the elevators. Sarin frowned and took a few steps toward it, then looked around nervously and headed toward the building entrance. Bobby followed. Once Bobby was outside, Her height was both an advantage and a disadvantage. Being a head and a half taller than most everyone around her meant that she could afford to stay pretty far behind Sorin as he hurried along the sidewalk. She could spot the top of his head from half a city block away. At the same time, if he looked behind him, he couldn't miss her face sticking up a good third of a meter out of the crowd. But he didn't turn around. In fact, he appeared to be in something of a hurry, pushing his way through the knots of people on the busy sidewalks around the UN campus with obvious impatience. He didn't look around, or pause by a good reflective surface, or backtrack. He'd been nervous answering the page, and he was being pointedly, angrily not nervous now. Whistling past the graveyard, Bobby felt her muscles soften, her joints grow loose and easy, her hunch slip a centimeter closer to certainty. After three blocks, he turned and went into a bar. Bobby stopped a half block away and considered. The front of the bar, a place creatively named Pete's, was darkened glass. If you wanted to duck in somewhere and see if people were following you, it was the perfect place to go. Maybe he'd gotten smart. Maybe he hadn't. Bobby walked over to the front door. Getting caught following him had no consequences. Sorin already hated her. The most ethically suspect thing she was doing was cutting out early to pop into a neighborhood bar. Who was going to rat on her? Sorin? The guy who cut out just as early and went into the same damn bar? If he was in there, and doing nothing more than grabbing an early beer, she'd just walk up to him, apologize for the cookie thing, and buy him his second round. She pushed the door open and went inside. It took her eyes a moment to adjust from the early afternoon sunlight outside to the dimly lit bar. Once the glare had faded, she saw a long bamboo bar top manned by a human bartender, half a dozen booths with about as many patrons, and no Sorin. The air smelled of beer and burnt popcorn. The patrons gave her one look and then carefully went back to their drinks and mumbled conversations. Had Sorin ducked out the back to ditch her? She didn't think he'd seen her, but she wasn't exactly trained for tailing people. She was about to ask the bartender if he'd seen a guy run through, and where that guy might have gone, when she noticed a sign at the back of the bar that said, "Pool Tables," with an arrow pointing left. She walked to the back of the bar, turned left, and found a smaller second room with four pool tables and two men. One of them was Sorin. They both looked up as she turned the corner. "Hi," she said. Sorin was smiling at her, but he was always smiling. Smiling for him was protective coloration, camouflage. The other man was large, fit, and wearing an excessively casual outfit that tried too hard to look like it belonged in a seedy pool hall. It clashed with the man's military haircut and ramrod straight posture. Bobby had a feeling she'd seen his face before, but in a different setting. She tried to picture him with the uniform on. "Bobby," Sorin said, giving his companion one quick glance and then looking away. "You play?" He picked up a pool cue that had been lying on one of the tables and began chalking the tip. Bobby didn't point out that there were no balls on any of the tables, and that a sign just behind Sorin said, "Rental balls available on request." His companion said nothing, but slid something into his pocket. Between his fingers, Bobby caught a glimpse of black plastic. She smiled. She knew where she'd seen the second man before. "No," she said to Sorin. "It's not popular where I come from." "Slate, I guess," he replied. His smile became a bit more genuine and a lot colder. He blew the chalk dust off the pool cue's tip and moved a step to the side, shifting toward her left. "Too heavy for the early colony ships." "Makes sense," Bobby said, moving back until the doorway protected her flanks. "Is this a problem?" Soren's companion said, looking at Bobby. Before Soren could reply, Bobby said, "You tell me. You were at that late-night meeting in Avasarala's office when Ganymede went to shit. Nguyen's staff, right? Lieutenant something or other?" "You're digging a hole, Bobby," Soren said, the pool cue held lightly in his right hand. "And," she continued, "I know Soren handed you something his boss had asked him to take to data services a couple days ago. I bet you don't work in data services, do you?" Nguyen's flunky took a menacing step toward her, and Soren shifted to her left again. Bobby burst out laughing. "Seriously," she said, looking at Soren. "Either stop jerking that pool cue off or take it somewhere private." Soren looked down at the cue in his hand as though surprised to see it there, then dropped it. "And you," Bobby said to the flunky, "you trying to come through this door would literally be the high point of my month." Without moving her feet, she shifted her weight forward and flexed her elbows slightly. The flunky looked her in the eye for one long moment. She grinned back. "Come on," she said. "I'm gonna get blue balls you keep teasing me like this." The flunky put up his hands, something halfway between a fighting stance and a gesture of surrender. Never taking his eyes off Bobby, he turned his face slightly towards Soren and said, "This is your problem. Handle it." He backed up two slow steps, then turned and walked across the room and into a hallway Bobby couldn't see from where she was standing. A second later, she heard a door slam. "Shit," Bobby said. "I bet I'd have scored more points with the old lady if I'd gotten that memory stick back." Soren began to shuffle toward the back door. Bobby crossed the space between them like a cat, grabbing the front of his shirt and pulling him up until their noses were almost touching. Her body felt alive and free for the first time in a long time. "What are you going to do?" he said through a forced smirk. "Beat me up?" "No," Bobby replied, shifting to an exaggerated Mariner Valley drawl. "I'm gonna tell on you, boy." Chapter 26. Holden. Holden watched the monster quiver as it huddled against the cargo bay bulkhead. On the video monitor, it looked small and washed out and grainy. He concentrated on his breathing. Long, slow breath in. Fill up the lungs all the way to the bottom. Long, slow breath out. Pause. Repeat. Do not lose your shit in front of the crew. "Well," Alex said after a minute, "there's your problem." He was trying to make a joke, had made a joke. Normally, Holden would have laughed at his exaggerated drawl and comic obviousness. Alex could be very funny in a dry, understated sort of way. Right now, Holden had to clench his hands to stop from strangling the man. Amos said, "I'm coming up." At the same moment, Naomi said, "I'm coming down." "Alex," Holden said, pretending a calm he didn't feel, "what's the status of the cargo bay airlock?" Alex tapped twice on the terminal and said, "Airtight, Cap. Zero loss." Which was good, because, as frightened of the protomolecule as he was, Holden also knew that it wasn't magic. It had mass, and it occupied space. If not even a molecule of oxygen could sneak out through the airlock seal, then he was pretty sure none of the virus could get in. But... "Alex, crank up the O2, Holden said. "As rich as we can get it without blowing the ship up." The protomolecule was anaerobic. If any of it did somehow get in, he wanted the environment as hostile as possible. "And get up to the cockpit," he continued. "Seal yourself in. If the goo somehow gets loose on the ship, I need your finger on the reactor overrides." Alex frowned and scratched his thin hair. That seems a little extreme. Holden grabbed him by the upper arms, hard. Alex's eyes went wide and his hands came up in an automatic gesture of surrender. Beside him, the botanist blinked in confusion and alarm. This was not the best way to instill confidence. In other circumstances, Holden might have cared. "Alex," Holden said, not able to stop himself from shaking even while clutching the pilot's arms. "Can I count on you to blow this ship into gas if that shit gets in here? Because if I can't, consider yourself relieved of duty and confined to quarters immediately." Alex surprised him, not by reacting in anger, but by reaching up and putting his hands on Holden's forearms. Alex's face was serious, but his eyes were kind. "Seal myself into the cockpit and prepare to scuttle the ship. Aye, aye, sir," he said. "What's the stand-down order?" "Direct order from myself or Naomi," Holden replied with a hidden sigh of relief. He didn't have to say, "If that thing gets in here and kills us, you're better off going up with the ship." He let go of Alex's arms and the pilot took one step back, his broad, dark face wrinkled with concern. The panic that threatened to overwhelm Holden might get out of his control if he allowed anyone to feel sympathy for him, so he said, "Now, Alex, do it now." Alex nodded once, looked like he wanted to say something else, then spun on his heel and went to the crew ladder and up toward the cockpit. Naomi descended the same ladder a few moments later, and Amos came up from below a short time after that. Naomi spoke first. "What's the plan?" They'd been intimate long enough for Holden to recognize the barely concealed fear in her voice. Holden paused to take two more long breaths. "Amos and I will go see if we can't drive it out of the cargo bay doors. Get them open for us." "Done," she said, and headed up the ladder to ops. Amos was watching him, a speculative look in his eyes.
"So, Cap, how do we drive it out those doors?"
"Well," Holden replied, "I was thinking we shoot the shit out of it and then take a flamethrower to any pieces that fall off, so we'd better gear up." Amos nodded.
"Damn, I feel like I just took that shit off."
Holden was not claustrophobic. No one who chose long-flight space travel as a career was. Even if a person could somehow con their way past the psychological profiles and simulation runs, one trip was usually enough to separate those who could handle long periods in confined spaces from those who went bug-fuck and had to be sedated for the trip home. As a junior lieutenant, Holden had spent days in scout ships so small that you literally couldn't bend over to scratch your feet. He'd climbed around between the inner and outer hulls of warships. He'd once been confined to his crash couch for 21 days during a fast-burn trip from Luna to Saturn. He never had nightmares of being crushed or being buried alive. For the first time in his decade and a half of nearly constant space travel, the ship he was on felt too small. Not just cramped, but terrifyingly constricted. He felt trapped, like an animal in a snare. Less than 12 meters away from where he stood, someone infected with the protomolecule was sitting in his cargo bay, and there was nowhere he could go to get away from it. Putting on his body armor didn't help this feeling of confinement. The first thing that went on was what the grunts called the full-body condom. It was a thick black bodysuit, made of multiple layers of Kevlar, rubber, impact-reactive gel, and the sensor network that kept track of his injury and vital status. Over that went the slightly looser environment suit, with its own layers of self-sealing gel to instantly repair tears or bullet holes, and finally, the various pieces of strap-on armor plating that could deflect a high-velocity rifle shot or ablate the outer layers to shed the energy of a laser. To Holden, it felt like wrapping himself in his own death shroud. But even with all its layers and weight, it still wasn't as frightening as the powered armor that recon Marines wore would have been, what the Navy boys called walking coffins. The idea behind the name being that anything powerful enough to break the armor would liquefy the marine inside, so you didn't bother to open it. You just tossed the whole thing into the grave. This was hyperbole, of course, but the idea of going into that cargo bay wearing something that he wouldn't even be able to move without the power-enhanced strength would have scared the shit out of him. What if the batteries died? Of course, a nice suit of strength-augmenting armor might be handy when trying to throw monsters off the ship.
"That's on backward," Amos said, pointing at Holden's thigh.
"Shit," Holden said. Amos was right. He'd been so far up his own ass that he'd screwed up the buckles on his thigh armor.
"Sorry, I'm having a hard time staying focused here."
"Scared shitless," Amos said with a nod.
"Well, I wouldn't say. Wasn't talking about you," Amos said. "Me. I'm scared shitless of walking into the cargo bay with that thing in there. And I didn't watch Eros turn into goo at close range. So I get it. Right there with you, Jim."
It was the first time in Holden's memory that Amos had called him by his first name. Holden nodded back at him, then went about straightening out his thigh armor.
"Yeah," he said. "I just yelled at Alex for not being scared enough."
Amos had finished with his armor and was pulling his favorite auto shotgun out of his locker.
"No shit."
"Yeah. He made a joke, and I'm scared out of my skull, so I yelled at him and threatened to relieve him."
"Can you do that?" Amos asked. "He's kind of our only pilot."
"No, Amos, no, I can't kick Alex off the ship any more than I can kick you or Naomi off the ship. We're not even a skeleton crew. We're whatever you have when you don't have a skeleton."
"Worried about Naomi leaving?"
Amos said. He kept his voice light, but his words hit like hammer blows. Holden felt the air go out of him and had to focus on breathing again for a minute.
"No," he said. "I mean, yes, of course I am. But that's not what has me freaked out right now."
Holden picked up his assault rifle and looked at it, then put it back in his locker and took out a heavy, recoilless pistol instead. The self-contained rockets that were its ammunition wouldn't impart thrust and send him flying all over the place if he fired it in zero-G.
"I watched you die," he said, not looking at Amos.
"Huh?"
"I watched you die. When that kidnap team, whoever the hell they were, took us. I saw one of them shoot you in the back of the head, and I saw you drop face first on the floor. There was blood everywhere."
"Yeah, but I know it was a non-lethal round. I know they wanted us alive. I know the blood was your broken nose when your head slammed into the floor. I know all of that now. At the time, what I knew was that you'd just been shot in the head and killed."
Amos slid a magazine into his shotgun and racked around, but other than that, didn't make a sound.
"All of this is really fragile," Holden said, waving around at Amos and the ship. "This little family we have. One fuck-up and something irreplaceable gets lost."
Amos was frowning at him now.
"This is still about Naomi, right?"
"No. I mean, yes, but no. When I thought you were dead, it knocked all the wind out of me. And right now, I need to focus on getting that thing off the ship, and all I can think about is losing one of the crew."
Amos nodded, slung the shotgun over his shoulder, and sat down on the bench next to his locker.
"I get it. So, what do you want to do?"